I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 7034, establishing the Works Progress Administration. The WPA employed millions in public works projects during the Great Depression. As many as 8.5 million Americans worked for the WPA at some point between the years 1935 and 1943. At its height, over 3 million Americans were working WPA jobs. These jobs included the construction of roads, bridges, utilities, and parks. It also meant the construction of new schools, libraries, public buildings, and housing. Many WPA jobs also employed musicians, artists, and writers in literature and art projects. The program's goals were to provide one job to every household suffering long-term unemployment. Some of the most famous projects included LaGuardia Airport in New York City, Blue Ridge Parkway, and the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Artists like Jacob Lawrence and Mark Rothko were employed at the Federal Arts Project. Historian Eric Loomis notes that the Federal Writers Project began the field of oral histories with extensive interviews of surviving ex-slaves. The WPA also bolstered federal funding for school lunches. The program was initially criticized for underemployment of African Americans who suffered disproportionately during the Depression. But many black leaders later hailed the WPA as providing job opportunities to blacks and keeping race discrimination to a minimum, at least in the North. The right attacked the program as a hotbed for communists and a scheme to build Democratic Party patronage. By 1940, WPA projects shifted towards war preparation and defense-related projects. When the country reached full employment in 1942, the WPA ceased to exist by July of 1943.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we are most certainly in interesting times, and in these kind of interesting times, we need a little humor, something to make you laugh, even when it's incredibly absurd what's going on. In fact, you know, today the CDC and the FDA, they paused on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and which is, you got a bunch of people, you know, kind of up in arms. When you look at the numbers, though, 6 women out of 6.8 million people developed blood clots. And I'm sitting there going, six women stopped this whole thing? It's kind of crazy. Then you had the former guy chiming in saying, no, it's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. Because evidently Joe Biden might have stock in one of the other companies. Very strange. But here to help us get through this, maybe with a smile and a laugh, I've asked Trey Crowder to come talk with us. Trey is a writer, comedian, the co-author of the Liberal Redneck Manifesto, Dragon Dixie Out of the Dark. Trey, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Yeah, glad to be here, buddy.
So what do you think of this Johnson & Johnson thing? Six women who were probably just sitting too long in the car. They got the blood clots.
Yeah, I think it's nothing to worry about for that reason. I mean, you know, like canned meat has a higher rate of messing your blood up, I would think, than 6 out of 7 million. You know what I mean? 6 people out of 7 million. So I'm not at all worried about it. But as soon as I saw it, I was like, well, I know what this is about to be. They're going to take this ball and run with it, you know, and make it like it's anti-vaxxers Christmas, you know, when it comes to this situation. So I'm not surprised by any of that. It just, you'll have that. It is what it is. But it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, what's interesting is the people who are most up in arms about this, at least the ones who are saying, see, I told you, are people who are never going to get the vaccine to begin
right.
with.
100%. Yes, they were never going to get it. It's people that, you know, I mentioned canned meat earlier, but I just think about like people that I went to high school with that I see on Facebook saying they would never get the vaccine, you know, because the government told them to. And I'm like, I saw you eat a possum because a dude named Lugnut told you to, you know, like you got real high standards now for what you're putting in your body. But, you know, it's because of the source. But you're right. They weren't going to get it either way, but that's not going to stop them from running their mouth about how big of a controversy this is, what has happened, when really it's not. The other thing is they're going to use it as validation to be like, look, we told you it wasn't safe, when in reality it's the opposite, in my opinion. It's like, no, we told you it was incredibly safe. It's so incredibly safe that you can't even get the vaccine that has a 0.0000088 you know, failure rate or whatever. It's not even open to you because that's how safe and regulated it is. But they're not going to see it that way.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I love these cereal box epidemiologists who are telling us that it was a hoax, that the virus isn't real, and now that this is horribly tragic.
Yeah, right. Well, they say, you know, they're like, yes, like you said, cereal box epidemiologists, they're, you know, do your research. They'll say, it's like watching YouTube with your mouth open ain't research, you know, like it's not what research is. It's not what that word means. But yes, it's infuriating because they're, wow, I'm about to make myself sound stupid and put myself under the same category for bringing this up. But what's the name of that phenomenon? Is it the Dunning-Kruger effect? Is that what it is, where it's like the people that are the least informed are the most confident about something because they don't have the capacity to recognize how wrong they are about the thing, you know? So, yeah, you see that.
Your average Fox News viewer.
Right, yeah. Just see it just through the roof.
I used to say that they're not stupid. They're just over misinformed. But I got to tell you, when you're constantly over misinformed and you go, yeah, I want more of that, I got to default to stupid.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely. Yes. It's definitely. I tell you what, though, it's weird. I mean, because I've said this a lot, because I grew up in Salina, Tennessee, an extremely rural town in Tennessee, like graduated with 60 people, which was the biggest class my high school had ever seen. No traffic lights, no nothing. And when I left Salina at 18, I thought I had it all figured out. I was like, okay, there's two parties. There's two types of people. There's liberals, there's conservatives, and there's smart people and there's dumb people. And that's how that works. Like the conservative, that's dumb people. That's where all the dumb people go. And that's just how that works. But after college, I got a day job working for, as I was getting started in comedy, I worked for the U.S. Department of Energy in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, with a bunch of like high level engineers and scientists and stuff. Plenty of them were what you would expect, but some of them were like, the most hard, I guarantee you some of them are QAnon people now. They were the most hardcore, like pro-Trumpy type people I'd ever met. And it made me realize like, oh, this is just, I mean, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like, it's more complicated than just smart versus dumb, you know?
Exactly. Although,
believe me, there's plenty of dumb for sure.
On all sides of the equation, most certainly, but just seems to be a lot on that side. And, you know, but here's the thing, you know, the Southern accent gets mocked a lot. So a part of your shtick is you're a bright guy, a college educated, first person to go to college in your family, you know, worked for the Department of Energy, which I guess, you know, what was his name? Rick Perry, couldn't remember.
I got out before Rick Perry, which is one of the things I've been most retroactively grateful for to my comedy fans is that they kept me from having to work for Rick Perry. When I worked for the DOE, the Secretaries of Energy was like the head of nuclear physics at Stanford or like the head of physics and engineering at MIT. That's who ran the DOE. And then after I left in 2016, it was, you know, a dancing Texas dip. Bleep, you know what I mean? Like, so but I missed the Rick Perry years, thankfully. But anyway, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, good for you. But you know, what I was getting to is, you know, the Southern accent is one that is, you know, synonymous with stupid, and you're clearly not a stupid guy. So you know, and I know a lot of Southern people who are brilliant people. How do you get past that?
Well, I mean, in my experience, you have to go viral saying some not dumb stuff.
So you just fully embrace it.
Yeah, but like, honestly, that makes it sound like I'm past it, and I'm not. People still, fans of mine who have been fans of mine for a long time will still say things to me. It's like, how did you get to college? You know, like that, like they can't believe it. It's like, you know, I drove, you know what I mean? Like it's a weird thing. It's fine. Like I had a huge chip on my shoulder about it when I was younger. It used to really bother me because I identified as like a smart kid and I made good grades and I was like, I'm smart, you know? I now know that I'm not nearly as smart as I thought I was. When I left Salina, I thought I was Good Will Hunting, right? Like literally. But I knew also that because of my accent and the way I sounded, people thought that I was stupid. And that used to really, really bother me a lot. But I got to a point where I realized that like that could actually be to my advantage.
No, because this is where I'm going.
Which is sort of how I use it in comedy. It's not, that makes it sound contrived. It's not contrived. It is it's authentic. But I just recognize that like, oh, that can work kind of, you know? So that's how I sort of reconcile with it.
So everything that comes out in your videos, which are fabulous, and I highly suggest people take a look at the liberal redneck stuff. It's terrific. But everything in there, you believe 100%. That's you.
Yes. And I mean, you know, you can tell by listening to me, like that, again, fans of mine who have been fans since I started the Liberal Redneck thing 5 years ago, still to this day, I'll get comments from people who are longtime fans of mine, and they'll say things like, Trey, you know we love you, right? You don't have to keep faking that accent if you don't want to. And it's like, I'm not faking it. Like, it's not. What people don't realize is when I first, my accent is like way, way dampened from when I first left my hometown. When I first left Salina, I sounded like this when I left Salina. Like, and I got made fun of in Salina for talking proper, talking like a city boy. So it's like people don't realize how relative it all is, you know. People think that I'm putting on a fake hillbilly accent. It's like, I've worked really hard to proper my accent up, actually.
You're presentable. Got your Sunday best on.
Right. Yeah, so exactly.
What's the difference between a liberal redneck and a hillbilly? What's the difference?
Well, I mean, it's actually very, very regional. I've had this conversation with, like, the guys I tour with, Corey and Drew. They're from small towns, but in, like, you know, Corey's from North Georgia, Drew's from East Tennessee. I'm from a few, you know, like 100 miles west in Tennessee. And even in that short of a distance, like, in Drew's hometown, hillbilly was fine. They self-identified as hillbillies, but redneck was like a pejorative. Like, that wasn't a nice thing to be called. In my hometown, 100 miles west in the same state, it was actually the exact opposite. People, like, self-identified as redneck, and hillbilly was like kind of an insult. And now I feel like it's sort of neither and both at the same time. It, like, is there a different hillbilly traditionally is like Appalachian people, or people from the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And then redneck is, I mean, I think Jeff Foxworthy actually had the best definition for it. He says the glorious absence of sophistication. That's, I mean, I agree with that. But in turn, like, the terms themselves, I mean, honestly, I want to say they're interchangeable, but depending on where you're at in the South or in the country, people will get mad at you for that.
Right.
But, like, I, at this point, I kind of use them interchangeably, honestly.
Yeah, you see, well, you know, I have friends who live in West Virginia, and to be called a redneck is like the highest honor, because the term came from the Battle of Blair Mountain, where you had 10,000 striking miners who literally had bombs dropped on their heads by corporations, by the mine companies.
Yeah, there are West Virginians today who have tried to, like, sort of reclaim that designation for the word redneck, you know, because of that. And I get it. They should, because they should be proud of Blair Mountain and their labor history and everything. But, like, I think it's too far gone now to get it back to that. But I respect it, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just one of those. I was wondering if there was a difference from your perspective, because, you know, what's interesting is, you know, we kind of share a lot of the same views, but I grew up very differently. I grew up in an, you know, inner city housing project, the lone white kid in an all-black neighborhood. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and Beat the Crap Out of Him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a completely different way of looking at things, and yet, politically, we're somewhere on the same side of the map, which is interesting how two different people living in poverty come to the same kind of policy conclusions.
Yeah, because I've always thought, and look, obviously, it's one of the huge things in American politics is that it doesn't always work this way. You see a huge number of people, usually white people, who are living in poverty or grew up in poverty, who don't see it this way. But I actually always kind of felt like that what you just said, like, made sense. Like, I always felt like, because I grew up dirt poor, my mom was a felon and a drug addict, raised by a single dad who was on disability and everything. I mean, we had nothing. And I always felt like that to be sort of like progressive was the thing that made the most sense, you know, given my circumstances. And I thought it made sense that we're talking about Blair Mountain in West Virginia, like, poor people or working people or whatever coming together against, like, the man is the thing that should happen. Like,
right.
you should expect that. Like, that's what I would like to see happen. But because of all the different, like, you know, propaganda and ideology and stuff that's happened in this country, you don't see that as much as you should. But I think, like, in a perfect world, there is no poverty, but you know what I mean. To me, it totally makes sense what you just said about you and I, given our differing backgrounds. It makes sense to me that we landed on the same thing, because, like, I think it all comes down to money at the end of the day. You know, poverty, socioeconomic issues are at the heart of everything, and all the rest of it is, like, you know, whatever, different coats of paint that different people put on it to serve their own purposes.
Yeah, I always said it until recently. I've amended my views. It's not really about black and white. It's about green, because, you know, where I grew up, everyone was broke. But right. I'm amending that a little bit because, you know, the black community has been just, you know, just devastated by institutional racism and all of the, you know, the treatment by police. Look, when I was a kid growing up in the project, the cops weren't any better. And I got smacked around enough on my own, but it's clearly much worse in the black community. I want to get your thought.
No, real quick, I went through the same process you just outlined too, because, like, you know, it's funny. It's like if people think about rednecks, they think conservative. And if they think rednecks and cops, now they're going to be like, yeah, rednecks are Blue Lives Matter people. But that's always been wild to me, because when I was growing up, like, rednecks and cops didn't get along. You know, there's a storied history. Moonshiner, hillbillies, NASCAR started with running from the law. Like,
did you watch Dukes of Hazzard?
Dukes of Hazzard, Smokey and the Bandit. Every other episode of Cops takes place in the trailer park. Like, rednecks and cops don't get along. And I used to always feel the same way as you. Was like, nah, black and white, none of that's real. It is. It's just about green. It's poor people. That's what it is, because they hate us too. They hate poor white people too. And, like, they being rich people, they do hate poor white people. But, like you just said, it ain't. It's not the same thing, though. There is still a difference, and it is worse for, you know, I mean, because I'm like a well-to-do white man now.
You're Horatio Alger. You pulled yourself up by the bootstraps.
Right.
You're a somebody.
Yeah, right. But you can't change the color of your skin, you know. So it ain't the same thing. But I know exactly where you're coming from, though.
Yeah. I want to get your thoughts, lastly, on the union election that just happened down in Bessemer, Alabama. And some of the messaging that came out of there. I mean, there's a view that you can't organize the South. And yet, you know, the South is where we have to organize the most. Right. I'm curious, you have any thoughts?
I'm extremely disappointed, but not surprised in that result. I want it to be different. We're talking about this. I have a live podcast that I do weekly right before your show at 5 p.m. Pacific called Weekly Skews on my social pages. And we were talking last week in depth about Bessemer and how important it was. And I do think it's important. And we're talking about West Virginia tonight and labor movements and all that. And it's, what happened in Bessemer is hugely disappointing. But I was saying tonight, like, I don't know. It's hard because I think you need a government. You need a larger body in place who will actually look out for these people and do something about it, because I understand the perspective of, like, an actual working person in Bessemer who's being told by Amazon's propaganda, right? They're being told, like, look, all that's going to happen is you're going to lose your job. Like, you want your job to be better, but you're not going to have it anymore. If we can't treat you like crap, we're going to go somewhere where we can treat them like crap. That's just how it works. And when that person hears that and they're like, well, I mean, this ain't ideal, but I don't want to lose my job. Like, I can't fault that person. But I hate the situation, though. And as far as, like, the answer to it, I think there has to be a power structure in place, you know, higher up, that can just prevent that type of thing from happening, because I don't know what else to do about it. I'll try to make this a brief story. I've got a buddy that works for a very big company in Tennessee when they first came to Tennessee. And they were talking about unionizing. This is like Bessemer, but years ago now. And they were talking about unionizing, and they had an employee retreat they had on the subject of unionizing. And they told them, like, we're going to cover both sides, so you see both sides of the argument. It's going to be a fair employee retreat on the subject of whether you should unionize or not. He said he got there. The first thing was they went in this big conference room, and there was a big banquet table lined up with donuts and coffee and all this stuff. And they said, okay, the first item on the agenda, we have this woman from the union. She's here to talk to you about the benefits of unionizing. She walks in the door, walks over to the donuts, spits on all their donuts, and starts berating all of them to their face, because obviously she didn't work for the union. But that's what they like. That's how over the top they are with the demonizing of unions. And it's like, it's we need something.
Yep. I'm right there with
you. It's rough. It's a rough situation.
And we got lots to do. And like I said, you know, we do need legislation. But Trey, I appreciate you taking time for us. I got to tell you, you make me laugh. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Absolutely, Rick. I'd love to. Thank you, buddy.
Beautiful. Good stuff. Trey Crowder, the comedian, co-author of the Liberal Redneck Manifesto, Dragging Dixie Out of the Dark. Make sure you take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 7034, establishing the Works Progress Administration. The WPA employed millions in public works projects during the Great Depression. As many as 8.5 million Americans worked for the WPA at some point between the years 1935 and 1943. At its height, over 3 million Americans were working WPA jobs. These jobs included the construction of roads, bridges, utilities, and parks. It also meant the construction of new schools, libraries, public buildings, and housing. Many WPA jobs also employed musicians, artists, and writers in literature and art projects. The program's goals were to provide one job to every household suffering long-term unemployment. Some of the most famous projects included LaGuardia Airport in New York City, Blue Ridge Parkway, and the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Artists like Jacob Lawrence and Mark Rothko were employed at the Federal Arts Project. Historian Eric Loomis notes that the Federal Writers Project began the field of oral histories with extensive interviews of surviving ex-slaves. The WPA also bolstered federal funding for school lunches. The program was initially criticized for underemployment of African Americans who suffered disproportionately during the Depression. But many black leaders later hailed the WPA as providing job opportunities to blacks and keeping race discrimination to a minimum, at least in the North. The right attacked the program as a hotbed for communists and a scheme to build Democratic Party patronage. By 1940, WPA projects shifted towards war preparation and defense-related projects. When the country reached full employment in 1942, the WPA ceased to exist by July of 1943.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you know how much I love the stories coming out of the Capitol insurrection and the stupidity that goes along with it. Well, this one's just as good. William Robert Norwood III. Yes, there were two before him. He texted the day of the big deal that he was going to dress up, look just like Antifa. And he was going to get away with it. He was going to get away with anything he wanted. So he did. He dressed up like Antifa, whatever uniform I guess he thinks they have. He dressed up in that. He stormed the Capitol. He did his deal, beat up some cops, destroyed some stuff, stole some stuff. And then texted to a friend that he got away with it. except he didn't. On February 25th, he was arrested for violent entry, disorderly conduct, obstruction of justice, theft of government property, host of other charges. Yeah, he got away with it. And what I love is when these criminals who think they got away with it decided to broadcast their crimes. Strange times we live in. Anyway, here to share some fun and excitement, CPAC, the golden big boy. All of that, I've asked Steve Hofstetter, comedian, to come back and share some thoughts and maybe explain why. Why in the middle of a pandemic, in the winter, would you move from L.A. to Pittsburgh? Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Appreciate it.
So what do you think of these guys who constantly broadcasted their treason and then somehow are shocked when they got caught?
Well, I mean, I do understand it in a way, because as we learned from the impeachment process, apparently you can't get charged for a crime if you've already finished committing the crime. So if we use that as an example, then it would seem like that guy got away with it.
Yeah, well, I hope he takes solace in that as he's sitting in prison. Hopefully he sits there for a very long time, because he got away with it for that day.
Yeah, it is. Do they have access to Parler and Gab in prison? Who knows?
There is that. So let's get to the big question, the one that is on my mind. In the middle of a pandemic, you move from Los Angeles to Pittsburgh in the winter. Why?
I did. First of all, I chose the end of the winter. That was on purpose. When I put an offer on the place, they were like, can you do a 60-day close? And I did the math, and I was like, January, let's do a 90-day close. I'll be there at the end of February. I'll take a couple of weeks of cold. I have been looking at old buildings just as a hobby forever. I always wanted to take an old movie theater or bank or church or something like that, something with just this cool old architecture, and, you know, turn it into a comedy foundation. And when I saw this one for sale, I fell in love with the building. And the more I looked into Pittsburgh, the more I realized it's such a great place to be based as a stand-up. It is within a short drive of 18 other stand-up comedy markets, and it is within a short flight of 2/3 of the population of the U.S. and Canada. It's a great place to be based as a touring comic once touring becomes a thing again.
If it ever becomes a thing again. Yeah. Although, hey, good news. Texas and Mississippi, both 100% wide open.
I think Texas in particular, like the instinct as a comic is like make fun of Mississippi. But really, look at Texas, because they are dead last in vaccination rates. And I chose dead as the word in there on purpose. They are not only last in vaccination rates, every day they are either first or second in the most amount of cases, despite California being a much more populated state than they are. And they're doing very, very poorly with it. So why not celebrate by doing worse? What a great idea.
Yeah, no, I got to tell you, I think Greg Abbott's going to be the 2024 Republican nominee for president. I know everyone's talking about Trump and the CPAC thing came on. I think Abbott, I mean, the way he handled the pandemic, the way he handled the Texas freeze, I mean, he's continually falling down. And as we learned during the Bush administration, you only fail upward.
Yeah, well, Radu Bondar is a comic that I tour with sometimes, and he has a joke about Texas having elected a horrible governor. And after I saw him do that joke for the first time, I just went over to him and I was like, which one do you mean? Like, it's been a couple.
Bush, Perry, which one?
Yeah, Bush, Perry, Abbott. It's been, it's almost like it's a challenge where they're like, who can we elect next? And it's getting worse every time. It's amazing that of the three of them, Bush was probably their best.
Well, you know, I don't even know where to go with that, because it's funny, but it's not even a joke.
Yeah, it's. I actually, here's what I think. I think they're playing 3D chess, because they just had this horrible, horrible failure of their utility policy and their energy policy. And they realized that because they privatized this, that, you know, the next time they have a storm, which will happen again, that a lot of people are going to die. And they were like, how do we prevent people from dying in the next storm? And they were like, I know, if they die of COVID before the storm, then they can't get killed by the storm. It's brilliant.
And again, that's not even funny, but it seems to be what it is. Now, let's get back to the church. You bought a church.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you can't have the church wide open yet, or can you? Can you?
No. But even if we're allowed to, we're not going to until COVID is behind us. It's been interesting because a lot of the neighbors are really interested in what's going on, and, you know, they'll stop by and say hi, and I have to just be like, hey, I'm not inviting you in. Like, COVID is still a thing. You're very sweet to come say hello, but you're doing it from outside and it's cold. So let's keep this short.
Yeah. Leave the pie and cookies. Move on your way. Leave the casseroles. Move on your way. Right.
Well, yeah, just because of the situation that we're in. And I am very excited to eventually be able to open. And in addition to, you know, to it being a church that we're turning into this arts center, there's also a 3-bedroom home on the property as well that we're going to be housing comedians for free. And so we actually just opened up that application process, and we've already gotten several dozen applications. And that's something that we can do before the end of COVID. And so I'm very excited about that. We're fixing the place up. I feel like I've been unpacking for 2 weeks, even though I've only been here a week and a half. And there's a lot to do, but it's going great.
So the website, steelcityaf.com. Steelcityaf.com. We'll get links out on how people can check that out. So basically what you're doing is like Comedy University kind of thing.
Yeah, it's something where we're creating this, you know, live, work, play environment, but there's also going to be a great deal of mentorship to it. There's going to be, you know, a great deal of learning to it. Two of our board members are educators. We have an insane board. We have Elaine Boozler, Greg Proops, Josh Wolf, I Justine, Arian Foster. It's a crazy board of just, you know, kind of who's who in social media and comedy. And, you know, our vision is to teach the next generation to not take as many lumps as we did.
That sounds awesome. And I can't wait till things open up. And if we continue and if we do the right things, maybe it'll be sooner as opposed to later, because Biden has said by May we should have enough vaccine for everyone, even though I'm a big Governor Wolf's fan. You know, I think Tom Wolf has done a good job. Little freaked out about the, hey, we're going to start opening things up. You know, don't worry about travel stuff at this moment.
Yeah,
I would have liked to have seen that a month down the road.
Well, the thing that people also forget is that if you take the vaccine and, you know, let's use Pfizer as the example. It's a 3-week in between doses. And so if you were to get vaccinated today, you wouldn't be actually fully vaccinated because it's a 3-week dose and then 2 weeks for efficacy. So you wouldn't be fully vaccinated till mid-April. So if we have enough vaccines for everybody by the end of May, first of all, we have to distribute them to everybody. And even then, we're looking at mid-July. So it's gonna be a bit. Now, not everybody has to get vaccinated in order for us to reopen again, just enough people, but it's still gonna take a while. And at the current pace that we're on right now, we don't hit 70% until late September.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at vaccination stats like it's spring training baseball. So I've been.
Are you gonna get vaccinated?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean let me push someone out of the way.
So you're not crazy. I'm happy about that.
No. I mean, like the people who say, "Oh, I don't know what's in the vaccine. I'm not going to put it in my body." It's like, okay, you say that while you're eating Taco Bell and drinking Mountain Dew. So shut up. Like these are the same people who take pills from strangers. So you know what? Shut up and get vaccinated.
Yeah, to me, it's that simple. Then the rest of us can have something of a normal life.
Or
get back to somewhere near normal. I doubt it's going to be anytime soon we get back to normal. But I'm hoping soon. Because, look, I'd love to go back to comedy clubs. I would love to go back to doing the things we did before Trump and the virus and all that.
Yeah, I don't think normal is going to happen for a couple of years, because normal also includes international travel without quarantine. And that's going to take some time. But I think that we will get back to a shadow of normal sometime over the summer, I'm hoping.
Now, you guys have, you know, during this pandemic, you've been doing this online comedy club thing that I think is fantastic. Tell me about it.
Yeah, Nowhere Comedy Club is the leader in the digital comedy space. We have done over 300 shows. We actually just sold our 50,000th ticket. We just had Bill Burr do a headlining set for the first time. It was the first digital show he's done, and he expressed interest in doing more, so fingers crossed that he will. We've had about 15 shows from Mike Birbiglia. We've had Ida Rodriguez and Alonzo Bowden and just so many incredible, incredible comics doing shows. Not only that, but the guest stars that stop by, we've had Jon Hamm and Jack Black. And I mean, it's really just been incredible because distance is no longer an issue. Every Monday night, I do a show with a comic buddy of mine in Australia. So it's Tuesday morning for him, Monday night for me. And we tour together when we can, but that's rare because we have to be able to be in the same place. But, you know, for the last year, we've done a weekly show.
How much different is that than, you know, doing a room full of people? I got to imagine that it's harder to do it by yourself, to do it, you know, in this virtual world than it is feeding off the people in the crowd.
Absolutely. It is much more difficult. But that's also, but it's different the same way that performing in a theater is different than performing in a club, which is different than performing in a bar, which is different than performing at a college or a corporate event. Like every type of event that you perform at is a little bit different. And so digital has now just become a new performance skill. There are different types of jokes that work better that wouldn't necessarily work as well in person and vice versa. And it's something to get used to because it's not going away. The thing that really opened my eyes to it when we were considering it back in April, I did a little, you know, analysis, and 80% of the people who follow me on social media had never been to a live show. 80% of my audience had never seen me live. And that really opened my eyes to ask the question why. And the reason is because a night out is very expensive. In addition to the ticket, you're also paying for parking and food and drink and babysitting and things like that. Also, there are some people who live in places I'll never go to. I will just simply never go to. There was a kid who watched one of the digital shows hiding under the covers on an iPad so his parents wouldn't find out because he was a 16-year-old in Croatia. And there was someone who watched from their hospital bed. And we've had a few different people watch who have severe agoraphobia and aren't able to leave the house. But this is a way that they're able to get entertainment.
Yeah.
So it's life-changing for some people.
Yeah, I found out, you know, during the break that you actually came to where I live in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I thought this was a place that nobody ever came.
I did. I played the Carlisle Theater twice. Once was, you know, opening for a bigger act in order to kind of advertise the upcoming show. And then once was my show. And I'll be honest, as much as I enjoyed it, I'm probably not coming back because it is not a large market. And for the most part now, I play large markets. And, you know, either if you live in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, maybe I'll play Harrisburg and you can drive there. But most likely you're going to drive to Philly or Pittsburgh or Baltimore. And that's a hike. And that's a cost, and that's time out of your life. Whereas if you watch a show at Nowhere, you can get there 5 minutes before the show, leave immediately after, and already be in bed.
Yeah, and not get heckled if you show up 5 minutes late.
Absolutely. And also for the performers, you know, it has been incredible. I have dealt with one heckler in the last year. And
yeah, but whoa. But that's how I found you. I think what put you really on the map for a lot of us.
Yeah.
Is that you do these really fantastic heckle videos. And look, I don't want to get on your bad side.
Well, I appreciate that. But it and that's what's incredible, though, on these digital shows. You know, we're not getting hecklers because the people, first of all, you're on camera for the most part. I mean, you could shut your camera off if, you know, and do it anonymously. But for the most part, there's a record of who you are. You could get banned from Zoom completely and then you can't be a cat lawyer anymore. You know, there are repercussions. And not only that, it's so much easier to find the person. If you're doing a theater and you get heckled, you know about where it's from. And then you have to be like, who was that? And then the bouncer has to go over and try to figure it out. And then it's really awkward to get the person to stand up and slowly leave, you know, bring them to the lobby. Whereas you heckle in this, we see your mic light up. We know who it is. They mute you. You unmute yourself. You're bounced. Game over. And then we just get to do the show. It's the best.
Yeah, you don't need people like me. Like when I was younger, I worked as a bouncer in a number of places where we'd drag you out and we drag you out. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, we got virtual ones now. We just, you know, they people just disappear. It's the best.
I hope people will check it out. Also, the SteelCityAF.com, your new project, the Nowhere Comedy Club, and we'll get that out. Before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on the Bob's Big Boy Golden Calf, whatever that was, at CPAC thing. Thoughts?
Well, when Mexico sends their statues, they're not sending their best. The idea that it was made in, of course it was made in Mexico.
Of course it was.
Because this fake patriotism that the right tries to claim is absolute garbage. And the everything from disrespecting the flag to praying to false idols to the fake America First garbage, it was everything that the left already knows is true about the right. And they put it on display with no irony whatsoever, and then people kissed it and took pictures with it.
No, that was incredible. But my favorite was the magic wand. That was my of the whole thing. He was holding like a magic wand.
I didn't even know that.
Like a scepter of some sort. And I'm going, you know, it's the perfect bit. I mean, you're mocking religion. You're definitely trashing the Constitution. And then the magical thinking. I love that image. And I want one, a small one. I don't want a big one. I'd like a bobblehead one. So if someone makes a bobblehead one of those, I hope someone will send me one.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll send you half a gallon of gold paint, and I'll get you Bob's Big Boy, and you'll have it.
Well, that's the beginning, I guess. But great. No, I mean, it's. I saw that. I'm going, you know, this they've jumped the shark. I mean, this is really just CPAC is no longer has any credibility whatsoever. At one point, they did have conservative thought, and I paid some attention. Now it was just, well, and then the Nazi symbol. Come on.
Yeah, it is a convention of conservative con men. I think it should be called con, which could be spelled with C's or K's. It's up to you.
There you go. Good stuff. Steve, I appreciate the time, man. Good talking with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good stuff. Steve Hofstetter. Make sure you check out his work over at his website, stevehofstetter.com. We'll get links out to that. Also, steelcityaf.com. Most certainly take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day President Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued Executive Order 7034, establishing the Works Progress Administration. The WPA employed millions in public works projects during the Great Depression. As many as 8.5 million Americans worked for the WPA at some point between the years 1935 and 1943. At its height, over 3 million Americans were working WPA jobs. These jobs included the construction of roads, bridges, utilities, and parks. It also meant the construction of new schools, libraries, public buildings, and housing. Many WPA jobs also employed musicians, artists, and writers in literature and art projects. The program's goals were to provide one job to every household suffering long-term unemployment. Some of the most famous projects included LaGuardia Airport in New York City, Blue Ridge Parkway, and the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Artists like Jacob Lawrence and Mark Rothko were employed at the Federal Arts Project. Historian Eric Loomis notes that the Federal Writers Project began the field of oral histories with extensive interviews of surviving ex-slaves. The WPA also bolstered federal funding for school lunches. The program was initially criticized for underemployment of African Americans who suffered disproportionately during the Depression. But many black leaders later hailed the WPA as providing job opportunities to blacks and keeping race discrimination to a minimum, at least in the North. The right attacked the program as a hotbed for communists and a scheme to build Democratic Party patronage. By 1940, WPA projects shifted towards war preparation and defense-related projects. When the country reached full employment in 1942, the WPA ceased to exist by July of 1943.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So if you were paying attention over the weekend, evidently meat is not for dinner anymore, according to the Republican mouthpieces and the spin masters. Evidently, we're only going to be allowed to have a hamburger once a month, if we're lucky. 4 pounds a year at the most. And in fact, no more beer that isn't plant-based. Larry Kudlow made that up. I don't know where he got it. I don't know where he's drinking animal fat beer. I don't think I would want it. But hey, you know, good on the Kudlow man. And here to share some thoughts on the end of meat, on the really the last kind of culture war thing that the Republicans got on the climate. I've asked our good friend Pete Dominic to come talk with us. Pete's a fabulous comedian, world renowned, also host of the fabulous Stand Up with Pete. Pete, thanks for taking time for us.
Always take time for you, Rick. When I got your text today that you wanted to talk with me about meat, I said, I am Pete the Meat. Let's do it.
There you go. But plant-based beer, Pete. Plant-based beer.
Listen, as you know, Rick, I'm a very masculine guy. I, you know, have all the qualities of the most masculine of men, which is why I only drink meat beer. I only will drink beer that is derived straight from the rib of cattle and not of some dairy cow, of a beef cattle. That's where I want my beer to come from. And as a matter of fact, I refuse to drink my meat beer with a bottle opener. I will not open it with a bottle opener because I open my bottles with my teeth, Rick Smith. And that's how I drink my meat beer. And that's the kind of man that I am. And all these pansy ass liberals that want me to drink the plant-based beer, whatever the hell these guys put in their pansy ass plant-based beer, which is destroying the social fiber of America from within. I'm not interested, sir. Don't tell me to drink plant-based beer. I and my real American friends are going to continue to drink beer derived from cattle, and if you're a weakling, maybe venison. But that's where we draw the line, right at a deer, sir. Deer beer.
Deer beer. All right, there you go. That's a good one. See, now I have a conservative friend who said that the only beer that they drink are the tears of you liberal, you libtards. That's what they drink.
That's just, I have no problem with that. It's just very expensive because those tears are, they're not hard to come by, but they're hard to bottle up. It's very hard to create enough volume, which is why we need these types of wedge issues to keep those tears flowing into the dear beersmith. By the way, right now I'm just drinking an espresso.
Pinky up, absolutely, you got to have that. But here's the thing, and this is there's part of me that goes, I'm glad they've gone to this extreme because it's all they've got left. There's nothing left for them to do, nothing more to divide us on other than making up things about Biden's coming after your hamburger and you're going to get stuck drinking beer with barley and hops.
Yeah, but let's be clear, it's effective. I mean, if we on the left or liberals or whatever these labels don't even serve anymore. People living in reality, we're able to be divided that way. If you were going to tell me that, if you told me you're going to take something away from me that I truly enjoy, that I truly love, something that I eat, something that's an interest of mine. And Rick, if I believed you, I'd be outraged too. I mean, if you told me that you were going to take away, let's see, Honeycrisp apples. If you told me you were going to take away my electric car that I can no longer, all these, I don't know, whatever liberal ideas or things that we have, I'd be mad. And they truly believe, that's the thing about their arguments. And that's the thing that's so hard to be divided. We're divided on the right. They believe things that aren't happening. I wish that the things I believed weren't happening. I wish that climate change wasn't happening. That would be great. But they believe that the election was stolen. They believe that Joe Biden is going to take away their meat because these are popular narratives that get created in echo chambers on the right. And the difference is we they're not taking something from us. And we wouldn't believe them if they did, because we know how to look shit up. I mean, they just made this up yesterday. What's his name? Larry Kudlow. He's never been right about anything, but he certainly knows how to get people fired up and divided and get ratings.
I don't know about that. I watched it and I didn't get fired up. I just went, wow, what a poor, pathetic old dude. He's trying too hard.
Of course you didn't get fired up. He's not targeting you. He's targeting actually believe such nonsense.
You take my hamburger, I'm going to be one ticked off dude.
But you didn't believe it.
No, I didn't.
Because you knew that wasn't happening. That's the difference. People, if you really told me you were going to take the thing I loved eating a few times a week, I'd be pissed too.
Yeah.
By the way, if you told me my vote didn't count and the election was stolen, I'd be really mad about that. I'd be so mad I might even raid the Capitol. They are told things that aren't happening. And then the people get outraged and they spread the word on social media and with their friends. And they're all outraged about something they don't even need to be upset about, because no one's taking away your meat. No one's taking away your guns and other things that no one's taking away, that they just, they buy it up. They soak it up. They lap it up. They love selling this stuff on the radio and in TV with, you know, Larry Kudlow being the latest to sell. I mean, he has no idea what he's talking about. That guy did so many mountains of cocaine. It's amazing that he's still alive.
Now that I don't know about, but I do know that he was Trump's, you know, economic guru. And, you know, when you're saying the kind of things that he's saying, scary.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think about how Joe Biden and most presidents, including Republicans, they appointed people to their cabinet and to the federal government that had experience in the thing. We might have thought they were evil, might have disagreed with them. I mean, think about George W. Bush's whole foreign policy team. Well, that's actually a bad example, because he put Paul Bremer in there and he didn't have a lot of experience. But most of these guys had experience and knew what they were doing. They ended up being wrong. But Trump got people from TV. He literally appointed, this is so hard to remember and believe, but it's also refreshing to see who Joe Biden is appointing now. He watched TV, he saw someone he liked, and he gave him the most important job in the world. And it is amazing that we are still here and able to talk and that we weren't vaporized. And it's amazing that Joe Biden has made up for it by being the most, I think, courageously progressive president we've ever seen, and not only in policy, but especially in his appointments. You know, Secretary of the Interior is a Native American woman. I mean, that is just amazing. And so it's hard to believe that we were there not too long ago with Larry Kudlow in charge of our money.
Yeah. And look, we got a guy who's the head of the Department of Labor who actually got his hands dirty. I think Marty Walsh is a good choice for that. And
you know, Walsh, I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you've told your audience this, but I know it for a fact because I interviewed Marty Walsh in person several times. You know, Marty Walsh, he smells amazing. He smells so good always, every time. You know, sometimes you're around a guy and you're like, oh, that guy smells good. Is it detergent? Maybe he's wearing a cologne. Maybe. But that, then when you're around him again, you're like, oh my God, that was no fluke. Marty Walsh is a good smelling man. I'll tell you that right now. I'll tell you that, and I'll tell your entire audience that he smells delicious.
And why is that?
I don't know. Maybe it's a deodorant. Maybe
he bathes. Is that it?
Could be it. I don't know much about that. I live in a shed. I live in a damn shed.
I've never had the opportunity to interview him. We're trying, but I think he's a guy who can be very helpful. And maybe, to be honest, I'm not going to smell him.
Also, another interesting thing about him is, and I'm not sure where he's at with this, but I interviewed him shortly after he'd gotten sober. And so he's a guy who struggled with, you know, alcoholism, and he's been real open about that. And I he's such a great guy. I'm very excited to see him in the federal government, and especially at labor. It's a great point.
No, he's a guy who has lived a working class lifestyle.
For sure. You know,
he's gotten his hands dirty. He's had struggles. He's had all those things. Somebody who's going to identify with Joe Sixpack. I think he's a good choice, and I think he's going to be very helpful. And I hope he does a really good job with the task force that they just put together today through executive order to help encourage organizing and people to collectively bargain. I think that's going to be a good thing. But I want to go back real quick to the banning meat stuff, because you're right in saying that the right wing gets all bunched up in the panties and crazy when they think something's being taken with them. And here's a moment where I think the conservatives can upset you. There's a state senator in Oklahoma. His name is Nathan Dame, I believe his name is. Basically an idiot on Twitter. He introduced Senate Bill 1065 that's going to ban paper straws. No more paper straws. Taking your paper straws away. Literally taking your straws away.
Well, you're right. I'm triggered. the environment is the issue that I care the most about, that I probably know the most about. It's probably the issue that I'm most kind of militant about. And I've shamed ineffectively more cashiers for giving me a plastic bag or a plastic fork or straw I didn't want than I'm ashamed to admit. I mean, it's not effective, but this plastic is absolutely horrible, and more research, and you don't really even need it because anecdotally you see it everywhere. But to use this kind of thing as symbolic, as a cultural, to ban paper, which is so much more renewable for the environment, and you know, push plastic, he's probably getting money from the plastic lobby, which is the oil industry, really. But that outrages me so much. But here's the difference: he's actually doing that. That's actually something he wants to do. That may happen, as opposed to what the right is so often worried about, banning meat. That's not happening. And by the way, everybody should eat less meat. It's better for the environment, and it's better for your body. We're not banning it. Eat less meat. Eat more chickens. That's still meat. But come on. I mean, these aren't – but we have to absolutely have less plastic in our environment. There's plastic everywhere, Rick. It's everywhere. It's in everything that we eat, that we drink. It's choking the planet and every species all the way up and down the food chain. And this guy has really – you've really pissed me off with this information. I hadn't heard about that, but – I'm now going to go record tomorrow's episode of my podcast, and I'm going to channel all that rage at this guy.
Your loss of paper straw.
Who needs a straw? If you don't have some kind of Bell's palsy or, you know, issue, physical issue, the drinking with a straw is preposterous. If tribal people saw you drinking with a straw, why are you – just put the chalice up to your mouth. What does a straw do other than make your face look stupid as you wrap your dumb lips around it just so that you can get the fluid up in it? It is literally, there's no purpose for it. It's silly, it's unnecessary, and it's making it that much harder to get the drink into your mouth. A straw.
Yeah, I see. I use straws for one purpose and one purpose only. It's been years since I've done it. I was in high school at the time for spitballs, nothing more.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the same reason that Larry Kudlow uses them.
I don't even want to know how Larry Kudlow uses them.
He uses them to snort cocaine, I'm guessing. I don't know.
I was not going there. I'm guessing. I don't want to get sued. But here's the thing, and this is where I wanted to get you as the expert on the environment, or more expert than I am. We're in an interesting moment because the Republicans have come forth with a bunch of plans that they claim are going to address that. In fact, the congressman from here in Pennsylvania, Glenn Thompson, has come out and said that we're not debating whether or not climate change is real. Those days are over. The debate is simply how to best address climate change. So he's saying that the Republicans have moved on from the days of James Inhofe and snowballs and George Will of It's Summer. Now they believe they're now believers that climate change is real.
Well, to some extent, they are catching up because markets are making them. I mean, a generation ago, we should have been subsidizing and we still should be renewable energy. But the truth is now, renewable energy, especially solar and wind, has caught up with the price of coal, natural gas. Specifically, natural gas has helped put coal out, and renewable solar and wind is helping put natural gas, competing with natural gas. So it's a matter of making money. It's all they've ever cared about. They always put profit over people, profit over the planet. So they're not really tied to fossil fuels, everything that's under the ground that scientists say has to stay in the ground. If they can make money in another way, they'll go for it. And so green energy has changed. The markets have changed. It's become much more economical and competitive. And so they are changing their opinion with it. Of course, it was never about their opinion. It was only about the scientific consensus, which we have known for over a generation now. James Hansen made this, announcement discovery in the 80s when he was a NASA scientist. And it's been confirmed over and over and over. The pH balance of the planet is way off, and we need to do a lot of things about it. And if Republicans think they can make money, they will. But make no mistake, they're still going to try to sell every ounce of oil they can drill and puncture into our planet's carcass.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But the reason I bring this up is, the Republican Party is trying to reinvent itself. They're trying to be the party of the working class. They now care about workers, not so much about corporations. They're mad at corporations because corporations want those black people to vote. I look at this as another one of those moments where the Republican Party has been wrong on the wrong side time and time again. And now we've changed our mind on a dime and then begin to lie in a different direction. And the minions just kind of come along.
Yeah, well, they're telling them a story that is one that they've been told for their whole lives. And a lot of them are obviously directly connected to the fossil fuel industry, or they're invested in it. And then there's a lot of people that are just hardworking folks that work in coal mines and so on. You want to you want to speak to them and take into consideration those are real jobs making good money, and they're hard jobs working on fracking wells. But they're destroying the planet and they're destroying local environments along with them. I just read this great book, Up to Heaven and Down to Hell, by sociologist Colin Jarelmack, which is all about the fracking industry in Pennsylvania and how obviously so many people in that state have been just screwed over by the industry and the deal that they said they'd make when they bought their property and then beat the shit out of it. But they are going to continue to do whatever it takes to make money. I mean, they've always been on the wrong side of energy, not to mention foreign policy and pretty much everything else.
Yeah.
But anything that had to do with science, anything that is, Americans need to consider their health, from seatbelts to smoking to climate change. They've never cared about human beings or animal species in the slightest. They've only cared about their own bottom line, their own quarterly profits. And that's still the case with most Republicans. And the rest of humanity says, you know what? We care a lot about everything, not just, our paychecks at the end of the month, because there's a lot more to life. And so
there you go. We need air. We need water. We need to live. You're spot on. Pete, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Looking forward to having one of those plant-based beers with you in the near future.
I'll have a plant-based beer with you and any other wuss out there that drinks plant-based beer. These wusses. All right. I'm going to go drink ground beef smoothie. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate the time. Our good friend Pete Dominic. Quick break. Right back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.